Well, Jesus, give me something. You're out there on the ground. You must have some idea what's bugging them.
Howard draws a long breath.
The only reason I can think of is Juster. This all started after Juster's... after what happened. Maybe they're reacting to it somehow.
The automator dismisses this summarily.
With all due respect, Howard, what the hell's Juster got to do with the senior cop team? He wasn't even a blip on their radar. Why in God's name should they care what happened to him?
Howard stares with loathing at the automator's gleaming white collar. This is not the first of these impromptu meetings. Apparently the contract he signed had a hidden rider, making him the automator's confidant and confessor. He takes another calming breath, gathers his words.
Well, I don't know, Greg. I don't know why they should care.
I mean, it's not as if... You haven't told anyone what we discussed up here, have you?
His eyes narrow on Howard, a hunter drawing a bead.
I haven't said anything.
Well then!
The automator ejaculates, as though the object of the exercise were to make Howard look a dunce.
You're on the wrong track, Howard. This has nothing to do with Juster. These kids have short memories. They've moved on.
The automator is right, of course. The boys don't know what happened. They have no reason to be reacting. And yet it seems to Howard that while the full facts of the Juster episode may have remained within these four walls, the spirit of those facts did not. Instead, it escaped to roil like poison gas down the stairs and through the corridors, slowly infiltrating every corner, every mind. It makes no rational sense, he knows. Still, he can taste it in the classroom every morning, the same darkness he encountered that day in the office. He knows better than to offer this to the automator. Instead, he says,
"There's a rumor going around that Father Green... that he had some involvement in the boy's death."
The automator sets his mouth, half turns away.
"I'm aware of that,"
he says.
"In which case, what it must look like is that we're sitting here allowing..."
"Damn it, Howard, I said I'm aware of it!"
He goes to the aquarium, to which three new fish have been added. Seabrook specials, the automator calls them. Big blue and gold fellows imported from Japan.
"Jerome Green didn't do us any favours quitting out of the blue like that. I know what it looks like, but obviously I can't say anything without making it worse, and I can't get rid of Jerome no matter how much I might like to."
"Maybe it would help if the school could be seen to be more mindful of Juster's... of his death."
"Mindful?"
the automator repeats, as if Howard has broken into Swahili.
"Just show, you know, that we care about it. That we're not just sweeping it under the carpet."
"Obviously we care, Howard. That's obvious to anyone. What are you saying? We should all go into the forest in our boxer shorts and sit in a circle and cry? We should build a monument to Juster in the quadrangle, is that it? Jesus Christ. It's not enough that this kid ruins what should have been a milestone year, that he sends our 140th anniversary concert down the crapper. Now we all have to stay depressed till June?"
Howard reflects his gaze primly.
"It's perhaps a question of ethos,"
he pronounces deadpan. The automator glares at him, then turns away to shuffle some papers on his desk.
"That's all well and good, Howard, but I've got a school to run. We need to find some way to boost morale. Get the show back on the..."
He tails off. A new light flickers at the back of his eyes.
"Wait a second. Wait. Just one second."
That afternoon, at a special assembly for second years, the automator announces that the 140th anniversary concert, in limbo after the recent tragedy, will go ahead after all. As a mark of respect, however, and in a spirit of commemoration, a percentage of the proceeds from the event will now be going towards the refurbishment of Daniel Juster's beloved swimming pool.
"It was really Howard's idea,"
the automator explains afterwards.
"And you know, it makes sense whatever way you look at it."
On the one hand, it gives the boys a chance to do something for their friend. On the other, it gets the concert up and running again, and also lends it that extra touch of gravitas, which it can definitely use now that it appears Father Furlong is going to pull through. In fact, in some ways, they were quite fortunate to have had Juster in the wings, so to speak. Not to be crass about it, but you take his meaning. The Automator's hope is that the revamped concert will revitalize the moribund student body.
Give them something to get excited about. Take their minds off all this gloom.
It seems to Howard that it will take a lot more than a Christmas concert to rouse the boys out of their present despond. He is surely not the only one hoping that Greg has bitten off more than he can chew. But the acting principal has a plan. He spends the day after the announcement sequestered in his office, making phone calls. The day after that, at a second special assembly, he delivers the news that RTE has agreed to broadcast live radio coverage of the event.
Historic occasion like that in the country's most prestigious school. Why wouldn't they want to broadcast us?
The Automator jokes afterwards, as his staff congratulate him on his coup.
Of course, it didn't hurt to have a couple of alums out there in Montrose, ready to twist the right arms.
It appears the Automator knows the boys better than Howard gave him credit for. News of the concert, or more specifically, the live radio coverage of it, creates a buzz on the corridors that hasn't been heard for months. Any grievances the boys had are forgotten. The air of introversion and menace dissipates as quickly and mysteriously as it arrived. Even students with no stake in the event, an ever-dwindling number, as the Automator invents a phalanx of new positions in concert PR, stuffing envelopes, and concert tech assist, sweeping the floor of the sports hall, get caught up in the excitement.
A rising tide lifts all boats, Howard.
The Automator comments approvingly.
That's simple economics.
The halls resound once more with rehearsing instruments, and it begins to look like the show, as the Automator has taken to calling it, will not only turn the school's annus horribilis around, but silence the acting principal's enemies for good. And then, with 8 days remaining until the curtain rises, the concert's musical director, Father Connie Lawton, arrives at the Automator's door in tears. A dainty man of a nervous disposition, Father Lawton detests discord above all things. He always climbs down before seriously disagreeing with anyone. He can't dismiss the most disruptive student from his class without feeling sorry 20 seconds later, and racing down the corridor to summon him back. As a result, his music appreciation courses are notoriously anarchic. In fact, they make anarchy look like a slow day at the library. And yet, at the same time, they are marked by a kind of goodwill. And the priest always seems happy there, in the midst of the melee, humming along to a field larghetto or a Chopin mazurka, while paper planes, pencil cases, books and larger objects fly through the air around him. Discord, though, that he cannot abide. As musical director of Seabrook Events for a number of years, Father Lawton is by now largely immune to bad playing. But what he was subjected to at this morning's quartet rehearsal, the egregious timbre, the proliferation of atonalities, the disregard for even the rudiments of timing, this was something else. This was something, it seemed to his ears, deliberate. A calculated and mindful assault on music itself. Just to recall it now sets the teacup trembling in his hand. And when he realized that the perpetrator was none other than Ruprecht van Doren, Ruprecht, his star student, Ruprecht, the one boy who actually seemed to understand music as he did, to recognize in its symmetry and plentitude a unique interpolation of perfection in our inconstant world. Well, knowing the boy had had some difficulties lately, he withheld from comment as long as he could. But eventually, he was sorry, but he could not bear it. He simply could not bear it. He asked Ruprecht quite politely if he would mind sticking to the score as Pachelbel had written it.
And what did he say?
He told me,
The priest crimsons at the memory.
He told me to sit on it.
He told you to sit on it? Those were his exact words?
I'm afraid so.
Father Lawton dabs at his forehead fretfully.
I don't see how I can't work with someone with that attitude. I simply can't.
Of course, Father. I quite understand.
The automator concurs.
Don't you worry about it. I'll take it in hand.
The automator has been aware, of course, of the staff room chatter regarding the former favorite's sudden decline. Until now, though, he has stayed his hand. Van Doren's projected performance in next year's state exams is calculated to lift the year's average by 4%. He, or his genius, must be allowed a certain leeway. He invites Ruprecht to his office later that day, and over tea and biscuits, reminds him just how important the quartet's recital is to the concert. He reflects on the concert itself, a uniquely prestigious and historic event, which is, let us not forget, to be broadcast live on national radio. He attempts bribery, offering to allow Ruprecht to keep his dorm room to himself, and then threats, ruminating on the positive effects it might have on one of the more troubled students, e.g. Lionel, to be roomed with one of the very gifted, e.g. Ruprecht. Finally, he loses his temper and yells at him for 5 minutes straight. This meets with the same response as every other tactic.
He wouldn't even speak. Kid sits there like a blancmange.
The automator slumps, huffing and puffing over his desk, much as Dr. Jekyll might have while metamorphosing into his fiendish alter ego. Howard adjusts his collar.
Can't they just play without him?
It's a quartet, for God's sake. Who ever heard of a quartet with only 3 musicians? And Van Doren's the only one with any talent. Send out the other 3 as a trio, you'd be better off pumping the audience with sarin gas, or just whacking them on the ears with a lump hammer.
He kicks over his wastebasket, sending paper and apple cores across the floor. Brother Jonas scuttles from a corner instantly, like a domesticated spider, to tidy them up.
We need Van Doren, Howard. He's what this whole concert is about. High-quality, timeless entertainment. And damn it!
The bloodthirsty eye staring sightlessly at Brother Jonas, who is winkling stray staples from the fibrous turquoise carpet.
I'm damned if I'm going to let some little blimp defy me on a whim. No, sir. If he wants a war, I'll give him a war.
The following lunchtime, the 3 uneponymous members of the Van Doren Quartet make a pilgrimage to Ruprecht's room. No one answers their knock, and the door opens only grudgingly, the way blocked by donut boxes, Pepsi bottles, soiled underwear. Inside, they find Ruprecht, on the first day of a 3-day internal suspension, lying on his bed with his eyes closed. By the wardrobe, the French horn slumps at a drunken angle, the bell full to the rim with Snickers wrappers. On the floor, his next-door neighbor, Edward Hutch Hutchinson, sits glued to Ruprecht's computer screen, watching an enormous purple dildo being plunged and replunged into a carefully depilated vulva.
The thing is...
Jeff Sproke begins, then breaks off. Every time he turns his head, he is confronted with a giant close-up shot of a clitoris. It's very distracting. He coughs deliberately, repositions himself, and tries again.
I suppose what we're thinking is, we've all put a lot of work into this thing, and it seems like a shame to let it go to waste, you know?
Ruprecht does not know. Indeed, makes no sign of having heard them. Jeff shakes his head and turns his gaze to Jeekers, who steps somewhat diffidently to the fore. Jeekers finds himself with something of a conflict of interests here. On the one hand, yes, Jeff is right. He has worked hard for this concert, and he feels that throwing away an opportunity to shine in public, where his parents have already bought tickets for not only themselves, but a wide spectrum of relatives, instead of merely on bi-monthly report cards, is profligate in the extreme. On the other, this strange torpor afflicting Ruprecht has been very good to Jeekers. After what seemed a lifetime laboring in Ruprecht's expansive shadow, spending hours over-preparing for every test, hoping for just one minuscule victory, appreciable only to him, only to be trounced effortlessly, time and time again, Jeekers is now, officially, best boy in the year, and it tastes every bit as sweet as he expected. The praise of the acting principal, scribbled on the back of his bi-monthly report card. The envious stares of Victor Hero and Kevin Watts Wong. The proud voice of Dad, crying out over the dinner table, "More carrots! More carrots for the best boy!" Much as he likes Ruprecht, he does not know that he is ready to give these up just yet.